VentureCast.
And as we know, whether it's a customer-facing business or manufacturing, those line-level employees have a lot of important insights, and often management doesn't really want to hear them. So when you show the respect to listen, and then when you start incorporating a bit of that into process changes, they feel an ownership in what they're doing.
Hi, and welcome to Deep Leadership. I'm your host, John Rennie. Well, I hope all is well with you today. It is another beautiful day here in North Carolina, and this episode is brought to you by our sponsors, Leader Connect, Ignite Management Services, and Liberty Strength. These sponsors help me bring these shows to you each and every week, so I encourage you to click on their links below and check them out. Now, today we're talking about the intersection between anthropology and workplace culture. My guest is Dr. Drew Jones. Now, Dr. Jones is an anthropologist who looks at leadership and organizational culture differently than most of our past guests. In this discussion, he points out the important role that culture has played throughout human history and societal evolution. Now, Dr. Jones highlights the need for leaders to create the conditions where organizational culture can develop organically. Now, he calls this concept open culture development, and I was fascinated by this unique perspective, and I know you will as well. So, are you ready to dive in? Let's get started.
Welcome to Deep Leadership. Leadership is a people business. That's the philosophy of your podcast host, John Rennie. As a former Cold War submarine officer who spent 20 plus years leading businesses in corporate America before starting his own manufacturing business, he knows that leadership matters.
Leadership matters.
Are you ready for some real world actionable advice from John as well as his expert guests?
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
The show starts right now.
Welcome to the Deep Leadership Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Drew Jones. Drew is an anthropologist, former business school professor, and practicing management consultant. He is a founding partner of Experient, a workplace culture and strategy consultancy. Over the past 20 years, Drew has worked on culture, leadership, and workplace design projects with clients throughout the U.S., Europe, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. He is published widely in academic management journals and magazines, and has published three previous books on design thinking and innovation, co-working, and activity-based working. His new book is called Open Culture Handbook, Five Questions to Drive Engagement and Innovation. And I'm excited I'm on the show to talk more about how to create a culture that drives engagement. So, Drew, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it, John. It's great to be here.
It is great to meet you. And I think I've got to start off with the question. You're an anthropologist. So what is an anthropologist doing in the management consulting world writing about culture?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's two parts to that. One is just the story of how I got into business. But two, you know, anthropology is the science of human culture. So as a discipline, it's kind of our jam, if you will. So there have always been anthropologists involved in the business world. Most of us, though, we're small, relatively small tribe. Most are in the consumer and market research space, consumer experience research, and corporate innovation. So if you look at companies like IDEO, the design firm, as well as a lot of large tech firms, Microsoft, Intel, Google, Cisco, they all hire lots of anthropologists and generally, but for the external facing roles, not so much in workplace culture and HR issues. So my sort of domain, if you will, is there fewer of us than there are on the consumer side. But it was just happenstance, really. I grew up in a business family. My dad started and ran an international business. So I traveled with him around the world a bit as a kid, but, I was wrapping up my PhD from the University of Wisconsin, and I did not intend to go into business, but I was going to an anthropology conference in Chicago, and I was kind of starting to look for a job, you know, an academic job. And I saw posting for a research consultant for an international marketing agency, and I responded to the ad, and I started doing that, and I've been in business ever since. And, you know, to me, it's where sort of, not that academic research isn't real, but the business organizations is where, you know, culture is unfolding and resides as well. And so it seemed like a natural fit, though other people, of course, it's always kind of a curiosity. People say, well, you're, what's an anthropologist doing here? But for, of course, for me, it makes complete sense. And then over the years, I ended up publishing some journal articles in business journals and spent about 11 years teaching in business schools, teaching organizational behavior and leadership and corporate culture, those sorts of things. And I've moved in and out of that over the years, but primarily the last decade plus a few years, I've been co-founder of a firm originally called Open Work Agency, and we rebranded after the pandemic, and we're now Experient. And so I'm pretty all in on in the business world. And this book, Open Culture Handbook, really my first time to sort of make a statement about what I really think about culture and also the way businesses tend to try at it, but really consistently get it wrong. It is sort of the frustration I had. And that was really the motivation behind the book, was to try to say, well, wait a minute, you know, we've got all these consultancies and everybody does these surveys and stuff, but really none of them are anthropologists. None of them hail from the discipline where culture is sort of the core of our discipline. And so yeah. I kind of wanted to bring some hard sides, some sides to it. And that was the motivation originally behind the book.
Oh, it makes so much sense, you know, the way you explain it. And because, you know, we think, you know, pure leadership management people, we think of culture as defined by, you know, what you would see typically in management research. And so you're looking at it from a completely different discipline, but related. So that's what I was going to talk about was, so how do you define like a company culture? And then how does your approach to managing culture different than other approaches?
Yeah. Well, to start, you know, with a little bit of the data is sort of the triggers. The problem I was trying to solve, essentially what I called the original title of the book was just the culture dilemma. But you look over the years, you know, the employee engagement levels have hovered around 30% for 60 plus years in the U.S. Around 70% of change programs fail. 80 to 90% of M&As fall short of their goals and often cited as poor culture fit. And research from Gartner, relatively recent, suggests that big firms spend around $2,200 a year per employee. That's not all external spend. That's also internal resources trying to get culture right. But less than a third of those that spending it has positive ROI. And like 70% of the employees in that sample said they just simply don't believe in the cultural aspirations of leadership, because often they'll announce a big program and it'll be the conversation du jour. And then 5-6 months later, people just, leadership stops talking about it and then it's abandoned and the proposed change never really happens. And I think that it's for a couple of reasons, and this tied to, you know, my perspective on it all. And that is the typical formula is you do a culture survey and it comes up with, you know, this organization is one of 6 or 8 types or orientations. But the leadership's goal is to say, but we'd really rather be a performance culture, or we'd rather be an innovation culture, or a culture of integrity, whatever the typology they're using. And then the change program is a classic gap closing analysis or program where you try to close the gap between the culture we have and the culture we want to have. But then the onus of change falls on the employees to change their behaviors to subscribe to and get to this idealized future culture. And that fundamentally runs against human nature, because, and this is where the evolutionary science comes in. Humans are wired for culture. It's in our cognition and it's in our the way we adapt to the world around us. And it's what distinguishes humans from other primate species. And what it is, it's really the primary mechanism by which humans have evolved as a species, in that it is a succession of adaptations, innovations, learnings, and sharing all that information to allow subsequent generations to have a leg up in their survival and their adaptation. So I try to tie culture as a driver of human evolution, and not just these abstract values, beliefs, and behaviors. And so what I'm trying to articulate is that when in groups, people organically develop culture. And the challenge for businesses, rather than trying to direct that and say, we want to go that direction, what I propose and what we try to do is to help companies create the conditions where culture can develop organically. Because I think we squander the cultural potential of organizations by, as I say in the book, you know, managing against the grains of human nature. And so my approach and our approach is really to say, let's get out of the realm of abstractions and focus on what are people doing every day at work, the material conditions of work. So for example, you know, one of the themes in the book is innovation, which is central to the whole science of culture from an evolutionary perspective, in that whether it was the first hunting spears, the harnessing of fire, domestication of agriculture, the maritime revolution, industrial revolution, information, all the way to AI, this is the human superpower. But it doesn't happen, and it never has, and this is where the anthropological perspective gets a little tricky for some people, not hard to understand, but like counterintuitive, is that humans are a cultural species. We, and in that respect, we're a collective species. We've created this ideology in the West and in America particularly that we come out of the womb as selfish individuals, and that the way we manage people is as individuals with individual performance evaluations, and it really pits people against each other, and it undercuts the potential of collective innovation. And so that's why I tune into two themes, innovation and engagement, you know, the five questions, that's the subtitle of the book. Because from this perspective, culture really can be best understood as innovation and learning and adaptation. And so companies that unlock that inside, companies like W.L. Gore or Intuit or the new Microsoft under Satya Nadella, where they empower employees to take risks and try new things, knowing that they're not going to get punished for trying and failing. And by creating an environment where employees can use the full measure of their creativity and problem-solving instincts and all of that, companies that innovate also have high levels of engagement and retention, because it's places where thriving, you know, where employees that have a lot to offer and have a lot of agency can act on their fresh ideas and try to implement them. And so that's why I say that innovation is as much an HR issue as it is a business growth issue. So that companies that I profile sort of manage to do both at the same time is empower employees to self-organize and to work autonomously, and the company captures the benefit of that in terms of pipeline of new products and services. So, it's a different view on culture, but each of the companies profiled is at the top of its industry financially. So the goal was to try to show a senior leader, hey, there is another way to do this than command and control, tight leash, micromanagement, all of these sort of things that, you know, not necessarily taught in business school, but I can tell you my colleagues, when I used to teach in business school, there was a lot of that thinking. You know, the whole purpose of this business is shareholder value and predictive, you know, whatever guidance we give at the beginning of the quarter, we got to make sure we hit it in the earnings and these short cycles. And so it was kind of the book was an attempt to sort of say, hey, here's a different perspective from a different discipline. But the goal is to also help them, you know, outcompete their competition, you know, from a business performance perspective as well. So that's sort of an overview of the background of how I got the energy behind the book. Yeah.
What's interesting is the way you describe it is almost an organic, almost, I want to say, bottom-up approach to culture change versus a top-down, here's the way we want to be, like a vision, here's our vision, here's what we're going to do, and then everyone's going to get innovation training, and then, you know, so the challenge I see is, like, senior managers, even middle managers, you are tasked with an assignment. Like, I want you to change the culture of this manufacturing plant, for example. And so you naturally think, oh, I've got to do it top down, right? I've got to set the vision, set the goals, get people training, you know, reinforce the behaviors that I want to see in the organization. But you're saying, well, hold on a second, you know, the best way to do culture change is the way we've been doing it historically as humans, right? It's more collective, it's more bottom up, it's more reinforced by each other's behaviors. So how does a leader begin to approach that type of change?
Well, there are so at the core of this sort of this perspective is peer to peer accountability and putting in place practices where there's consistent peer-to-peer learning, peer-to-peer accountability. So, for example, companies like W.L. Gore, the material science company that's created, you know, thousands of products, they really encourage project rotation. First of all, when you come into the company, you choose which lab you want to work in as a scientist. And then similarly, I could talk about this with respect to both Morningstar, the tomato processing company, as well as W.L. Gore. They have a concept called a CLUE, a colleague letter of understanding. And this is what I mean by tangible things. This is not an abstraction. This is something that a new hire has to do. So at Morningstar, the new hire writes what they call a CLUE, a colleague letter of understanding. And it is to back up one step, at Morningstar, there are no titles, job titles. Everything is self-organized. You have an owner, but all the teams self-organize. It's the leading processor of tomato products in the country. Every ketchup, everything, your tomatoes, whatever, most likely comes from them, from California. But what they do is they really pair, you know, radical autonomy with radical accountability. So a CLUE is a letter that you write to the team you're joining, but you write it to a specific individual on the team. And it outlines the value you feel like you contribute to you can contribute to the team for the coming year. But every month, the recipient of the CLUE posts the new hire's progress against their own stated goals for everybody in the company to see. So nobody can hide from their performance. And the team has the power to, after 3 or 4 months, kick the person off the island, as it were. And so on the one hand, you could say a traditional manager would say, wow, who's the managers? Who's in charge here? It's all very sort of self-organized at Morningstar. But they have very little attrition, super high levels of engagement, and it's because they really amp up this peer-to-peer dimension. And similarly, at W.L. Gore, what they do is, in addition to that, once a project is come to completion and a product is launched, they encourage employees to move to another lab so that they can take what they learned from this project to that project and share insights across different product labs. And so job rotation, peer-to-peer accountability, these are just some of the tangible everyday things that, as well as, you know, having in place a system like Google's classic 20% time, and all the companies that I've featured here have some version of that, where half a day a week, or maybe a day a week or a day a month, you're encouraged to meet with a group of people to try to come up with either a new process or a new product or service. So it's built into the job. So that's what I mean. You know, all these companies talk about we have a culture of integrity and innovation. But when you talk to an employee there, they say, we've never done any innovation in my job. It's just, I don't know what you're talking about. So, you know, and that's one of the questions of the book is what do people do every day? Are they just scaling existing products or cutting costs? Or is there some time in their work week or month where they're using that problem-solving hardwiring that we have, which is part of culture, is solving problems. So when you empower that, you not only create potentially new products and services or processes internally, whatever the goal, but you're also switching people on in a way where they team up with other people. And then that's where I think, you know, you unlock culture organically is when people are allowed to kind of do these things together as opposed to just staying in their lane with singular job, which they do every day of the year kind of thing.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
As a leader, you're responsible for the mission and the people assigned to you. Regardless of the size of your team, employees are depending on you for their lives and careers. For the sake of your team and the people who entrust you with this role, you need to master the skills to become a great leader. Best-selling leadership author John Rennie is proud to introduce the Qualified Leadership Book Series. This new series teaches you how to become a people-centered leader. Great leaders know that employees who are respected, appreciated, and allowed to grow will go the extra mile. These books provide real-world leadership wisdom written from a hands-on perspective. If you want to be a more effective leader, this is the one book series you should read this year. This three-book series contains the following best-selling leadership books: I Have the Watch, You Have the Watch, and All in the Same Boat, for one low price of $39.99. Begin your journey to become a leader worth following. Go to johnsrennie.com and get your order in today.
This episode is brought to you by Leader Connect, a leadership training company and video platform founded by the leadership book author and Deep Leadership Podcast guest, Neil Jurd. Leader Connect is a video and podcast streaming platform for leaders and teams. Watch it alone or as a team, and each video supports you and your team, allowing you to improve performance and build a great culture. Join hundreds of experts and learn about leadership, planning, public speaking, team building, mindfulness, and a range of other subjects that will help you lead well and build a great team. I'm proud to say that I'm one of the experts on this platform. Leader Connect is offering a 10% discount to all Deep Leadership listeners. Go to leader-connect.co.uk and enter the code DEEP at checkout. Master your leadership with Leader Connect.
This episode is brought to you by Ignite Management Services. Ignite is led by Mike Watson, who you might remember from episode 137. Mike and his team believe that everything starts with leadership, whether it's strategy execution or cultural transformation. It's the role of the leader to create the conditions for their people to succeed. The team at Ignite can help you develop critical habits to enhance your leadership capability and transform your business. Ignite Management is now offering the Resilient Leadership Assessment Tool. This is an online questionnaire designed to assess and guide leadership development, coaching, and team building. It provides leaders an opportunity to gain insights into their leadership strengths and development needs. After taking this assessment, you will receive a custom detailed report that provides practical and actionable recommendations to enhance your effectiveness. I have taken this assessment myself and found it to be extremely valuable in helping me make changes to my leadership approach. Right now, Ignite is offering 15% off the price of this tool to the Deep Leadership audience. Go to ignitemanagement.ca and enter the code START15 at checkout to get started today.
So in other words, the leader, though, creates the conditions, for that type of culture to emerge, right?
Yeah,
I think it sounds like you're in other words, giving time for people to innovate, right? Actually listening to ideas, a process by which, you know, new employees sign up to teams, the idea of eliminating job titles. These are management or leadership actions,
right? Actions that can create the environment for a positive culture to emerge, right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. I mean, even at scale, Microsoft right now, Satya Nadella has, and it's been reflected in the growth financially and share pricing, it's surpassed Apple as the largest market cap in the world, even bigger than Saudi Aramco. But part of the, a big part of that turnaround, I would say, is that, you know, his mantra, Satya Nadella, is experiment, learn, and share what you learned. And so there's an internal, and you won't be punished if you fail as long as you have an after-action review and we learn from it. And so at an organizational level, that's human evolution in a nutshell. You know, you trying to catch these animals that we're going to need to eat to survive, and then lo and behold, you realize you can run them off. You can run the buffalo off a cliff and kill 200 at a time, and you got food for, you know, the next couple of years. But that's not an Einstein moment. Einstein worked in a group with a lot of people. Watson was on a team of 20 scientists. Innovation is where the great man theory of just brilliant geniuses who come up with these ideas. That's not, you know, the first, I mean, we don't know the circumstances, but one of the biggest breakthroughs in this regard is, how was it that people in the Fertile Crescent 10 to 11,000 years ago figured out how to crossbreed wheat and barley to create really grainy food that created bread and you know, that was not just, I mean, it was probably some randomness, but when they, you know, so you just imagine some, you know, early humans thinking, wow, just plant this next to this, and well, this got bigger, and you break it up, and well, we can make bread. You know, it was the first bread. And so food's the very beginning of what we think of as civilization was food surplus. And that was a result of probably lots of experimentation that a group of people were tinkering with over a period of time. And so, so that's the idea is that if you can create those conditions, then we undervalue the potential of our employees terribly. It's like Doug Kirkpatrick says, he used to be head of one of the senior guys. I don't know what his title was. I don't think he had a title, but he used to be at Morningstar. He's gone off now and he consults about this sort of thing. He said, well, why do we not trust our employees to make decisions here that they make every day at home?
Yeah.
You know, when you come to work and you're not allowed to make those decisions, important decisions, I think as a human, we instantly are like, well, okay, I'm just here to collect my check. And you lose the that cultural potential, right away. And so this is why I think the futility of low engagement rates year over year and change programs fail, all the data that everybody cites, it's just persistent. It's just, I think in general, there's just this profound misunderstanding of what human culture is in business. And yet, you know, every year there's a new program that they want to try and they try it again. And then, at any rate,
Well, it's interesting because I just kind of go back to my first manufacturing plant led. I was 32 years old and I didn't know anything about how to run a manufacturing plant, right? So I actually relied on my teams. I relied on my people because I didn't know what I was doing, right? They promoted me. I was young, was inexperienced. But one of the things I wanted to understand, because I left the military where we spent a lot of time in close quarters, getting to know each other and know what each other did. And what I noticed right away in a manufacturing environment, you have your office people on one side, you have your manufacturing people on one side.
Yeah.
They don't share even bathrooms. The only time they're together is maybe in the break room, but they live two separate lives. And so I wanted to try to break that connection. And so I started this thing called Fridays on the Floor, where I'd work 4 hours the first Friday of every month. I worked 4 hours in a different department every month. And I started to learn like what they were doing. And they'd ask me questions about what I did. And so I'd start meeting with my management team. And I was so excited. I'm like, you don't realize We got bad tooling. We've got bad procedures. We've got these things we got to do. And my team didn't get it and initially. And so eventually I had my entire management team doing this every month. We do Fridays on the floor. And we started learning so much about the business, what was broken and the ideas from the employees. And suddenly, like, there was a tight connection between management and the shop workers. And we were then now working as a team together to improve the business. I didn't know anything about what you talked about, but it seems a lot like we were doing that, like, sort of natural evolution of the culture versus a top-down, this is the way it's going to be.
That's such a great example. That's exactly the kind of, and that's what I mean. That's not an abstraction. That's a materials, that's a management intervention. You go there and you spend hours like you did with your direct reports. You're respecting them. You're listening to them. And as we know, whether it's customer-facing business or manufacturing, those line-level employees have a lot of important insights, and often management doesn't really want to hear them. So when you go through show the respect to listen, and then when you start incorporating a bit of that into process changes, they feel an ownership in what they're doing. And that's profound. That can change the nature of a job for somebody. Maybe you don't have to pay them more money or change their title, but just that basic respect goes a long, long way.
Yeah, it's interesting because we became innovative and we became our performance. Our factory outperformed everybody else in the division. And they kept asking me, what did you do? And I was like, I didn't really do anything. I just asked the employees what we needed to fix. And we got them involved in solutions. And so it was almost a hard thing to try to teach or train or show or demonstrate what we were doing, because it was, again, from the bottom up. It wasn't from the top down. And again, I sort of stumbled into it only because I was inexperienced and I wanted to figure out the best way to run the business.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I talk about this a bit in the book. It's what I call it, you know, leading like an anthropologist, because for a cultural anthropologist, field work is everything. It's you go in and you spend time in the context where you're trying to learn. In my case, originally, my research was with the Comanche Nation in Southwest Oklahoma and New Mexico and North Texas. But it's empathy and humility to go and spend your time in that kind of context. And Jim Senegal, the long-term CEO of Costco, did that. They say he spent around 200 days a year on the floor at a store, but probably much to the dismay of his family and his wife. But employees said he would remember things like, you know, an employee's mom had been sick. How's she doing? And knew their name. And he was what I would call an anthropological leader, because he led in the field. He was the CEO, made a lot of money, and he was the first to up the minimum wage to $20 for a big box retail store. And he was also a darling of Wall Street, and still Costco still is. But he leads from the floor up, just like you're talking about in your case. And that's the one thing, frankly. I mean, this is where, you know, well, I don't want to take over all the time, but this is ties into kind of what Experian does in terms of the workplace strategy stuff. But anyway, I don't want to cut you off if you had any other.
No, but it's really fascinating, because you're looking at it from a completely different perspective. But what your solution is almost a lot of what, you know, a lot of transformational leadership is about engaging people to, you know, to help be part of the solution, part of the solving problems, company problems. One of the things that, you know, what it naturally occurs to me as I listen to you is that this helps solve the engagement problem, because now you're engaging people to help be innovative and help, you know, make the company better. So they're not just bringing their bodies to work, they're bringing their brains to work every day. So they're more engaged. And the other thing about, like, you know, one of the things we hear a lot about is the quiet quitting, the great resignation.
Yeah.
Well, people aren't going to leave companies that they're excited to be a part of, and they're being asked for their opinions and their ideas are being implemented. They want to be part of something where they share in the success of the company, right? So they're they're actively engaged because their ideas are being listened to. You know, they're not being ignored. And I think a lot of cases, our employees are being ignored. The smart guys in the corner office are going to come up with a strategy. We're just going to sit around and wait and listen to it. And yet we have all these smart people in our companies where we don't really engage them.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, so Experian is, I'm a culture guy sort of by training. Experian, we're a workplace strategy group. We help organizations, particularly now post-COVID, redesign their offices and policies around when and where people work. But we're advocates of what in the field is called, in the industry is called activity-based working. And that is environments where most people, ideally including senior management, don't have their own fixed offices, where it's what we call addressless officing, where, and this goes back to the 90s, the company that founded this practice in the Netherlands was in the mid-90s. So this isn't post-pandemic. So it was a digital-first way of working, you know, early leveraging of technology where employees had the option to work from home if they wanted, if they had a sick child or a sick parent. And the offices were designed with lots of different variety of work zones to accommodate, and that's where the phrase activity-based working comes from, different work environments to accommodate different activities you're working on at the time, whether it's a call, whether it's a meeting, whether it's heads down work, you're working on code or whatever it is you're doing, but you don't have a fixed office. And so the company, and this is a hard pill to swallow for a lot of companies, particularly a lot of American companies, but the idea is that if, and this happens in a good, in a full-on activity-based implementation, you find that the CEO and other senior leaders, they're no longer on the third or fifth floor protected by some personal assistance. They're working in the same areas where everybody else is. Of course, they always have preferential access to an office or a private space to meet with a client, or so there is some hierarchy there in terms of access to the rooms and the privacy. But what it does, it makes these CEOs, who in a lot of companies, an employee may even not know what the CEO looks like. They may have never seen him.
Yeah.
But in these environments, they're out there at a desk or a table, and employees can walk up to them and engage them in conversation. And the offices that do this higher levels of productivity because people are working when and where it's best for them. Higher levels of engagement and retention, but also fewer meetings and much higher levels of mentoring. And this gets back to the learning part. Young staff, and this is where young staff, I think, are missing out to a certain extent in fully remote offices, is learning from folks that have experience. And if those people are available and accessible on an everyday, not every single day, but on a daily basis, then that also creates, you know, enables that culture to grow organically. It also democratizes the organization because in an important way, because, you know, we go into a company and do an assessment, and you can just, the corporate hierarchy is built into the environment. You've got all the important people up here and their big 450, 500 square foot offices, and you've got the everyday people that are in these little 80, 90 square foot workstations in an open plan office, which doesn't work for anybody. And there's a resentment there.
Yeah. The us and them is every place I've gone to and I take over a business, I see us and them. I see privileges, you know, I see status, right? Certain people have free coffee. Certain people have air conditioned spaces. Certain people have their own parking spot. And there's animosity between us and them. It's like, oh, you're more important than I am. And I've always said that the most important person is the person either talking to our customers or building something for our customers, not me. Not me at all.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that would sound like a Peter Druckerism right there. But yeah, and the thing is, it's there are tangible actions that a manager can make, like you did. But it really is a mindset shift because it requires kind of a look in the mirror at those privileges and those perks that people get entitled, feel entitled to, and they feel like it's a measure of their success. And if you take that away, then you're really undercutting their whole sense of purpose or their sense of value and pride and all of that. So it's not an easy sell, I'll tell you that.
But, no, it's not. But I think if you, again, if you want to have the success that, you know, the companies you feature in the book, the culture transformations that they're having, if you want to have that type of success, you're going to have to think differently. And you're going to have to get into those uncomfortable discussions, and you're going to have to sacrifice maybe some of your privilege in order to get what, you know, again, get some performance level that is that's never been there before. And then get out of this 30% engagement trap that companies have been in, as you said, for decades. And if we want to do it, you got to change the rules. Drew, this has been a phenomenal discussion, and I honestly could talk to you for hours, but in the interest of time, sure. What final message would you like to leave with our listeners on this subject?
Yeah, you know, I think as I've come to the end of this project, I think that it's sort of a nod to our work at Experian, but I think that it's important that leaders learn to shift their thinking away from what I call from behavior to design. And that is, instead of assuming that you can compel through carrots and sticks employees to change their behavior to reach the goal du jour, that what we need to do instead is to design, whether it's policies, physical spaces, activities for employees, like the innovation activities, as well as to kind of walk management by walking around, and like you were talking about in your case, these tangible things, job rotation. I look at all those as design interventions. They're not abstractions. Each one of them is something you can implement on a Monday morning. And so humans are fickle, and nobody likes to be told what to do or what, especially what to think.
Yes.
And so this effort to change culture through behavior, while it can and does work, it's much more pragmatic, I think, to shift from behavior to design and get on with the business of designing the kind of environments that people respond to.
That is phenomenal. I think that is a great way to leave this discussion, because I think your approach is completely different. And I have not heard this perspective before, but having experienced some of it, I can tell you it is much more effective than trying to do a top-down culture change. And it makes so much sense. You know, we create as leaders the conditions that allow the culture to evolve to what we want it to be. It's a different mindset.
It is.
Yeah.
Max Dupree, long-term CEO of Herman Miller, the furniture company, said that in his book, Leadership Jazz, that there's three steps. One, hire great people. Two, learn how to communicate. Or those four steps: hire great people, learn how to really consistently communicate core strategy so everybody knows what's going on. Lead with trust, and then four is get out of the way. Mm-hmm. And of course, he was being somewhat flippant, but that's that in general, that's the outline is because, you know, Paul Zak at Claremont Graduate School cites some research in his sample, 40% of the employees in his survey could not tell you what the company strategy was.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So where do you go from there? You know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Because it's, as I say in my books, it's in a frame, it's in a cheap Walmart frame in the lobby, or it's in a dusty book somewhere on a shelf that no one's ever opened.
No one's ever opened.
Yeah.
Well, I saw all your books there. I'll go get one of your books. Which one would you recommend first?
Well, they're practitioner based, but the first one, Eye of the Watch, is one that seems to be the most popular. So it's a quick, easy read, very practical stories on how to become a more effective leader, for sure. But
is that a submarine surfacing?
Yeah, I was a submarine officer right out of college. That's where I got my basic training in leadership, is leading troops under the ocean for months on end. So
wow,
Yes.
Congratulations. And thank you. Thank you for your service, by the way.
Oh, thank you. But it was a great classroom to learn human behavior in some interesting environment. So I made 7 deployments during that time and got to see a lot of interesting human interactions, challenging leadership issues, challenging organizational issues in a dangerous environment with young people. And so it was a good basic training for corporate leadership, for sure.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah,
we need more of that. Thank you.
Well, fantastic. Drew, how can listeners find out more about you, your company, and all your books?
Yeah, so my books and all that personal stuff is at drewjones.co, not com, but .co, .co. And then Experient with a T instead of the C-E, .work. Experient.work. That's
fantastic.
Handles.
And we'll put the links in the show notes for those resources. And again, the book is Open Culture Handbook. And it's a completely different look at culture, and one that I can tell from experience is the more effective way to look at culture. Why spin your wheels doing the same thing that is ineffective time after time after time? Most companies are trying it. Let's listen to Drew. Let's listen to it from a different perspective, and let's put in natural systems that make sense, and that'll be more likely to be successful. So listeners, I highly encourage you to look at, go to Drew's website, look at this book, and learn a better way to do culture. So Drew, I want to thank you for being on the show and sharing such a great perspective on culture.
John, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I did as well. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening to Deep Leadership. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and share so we can continue to build a world with better bosses. Until next time, this is John Rennie saying take care and lead well.
Thank you for listening to Deep Leadership.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all you do.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. For more information and updates, please visit our website at www.deepleadershippodcast.com or johnsrennie.com. Until next time, take care.
Welcome to Transforming 45, the podcast that celebrates the incredible power of passionate voices. I'm your host, Lisa Boat. Join me in conversation with heart-led humans who share their deeply personal stories of transformation. Transforming 45 is here to uplift, connect, and remind you that it's never too late to write your next chapter. So get ready to be inspired, empowered, and transformed. Join me in this community where through powerful storytelling, we heal and reclaim our inherent magic.
Hey there, I'm DC. I host the Rock Podcast, Back to the Arena, The Interviews. It's about a 30-minute podcast where I talk one-on-one with a band who has released new music. You can find us on all the best podcast sites like Spotify, Apple, Google, iHeartRadio, and more. If you're a rock fan like me, subscribe today to Back to the Arena, The Interviews. Electric Acid.